Good morning, everybody. This is a great day. And I beg to move the motion that the chairman has put to synod. Having journeyed this far, in our long debate, we now come to a critical decision. Our 19 deaneries have already spoken. The people we represent have voted 10 to 1 in favour of this legislation, 362 votes for and 35 votes against, with some abstentions. Today, it's our turn. The change in the rules we are considering today was first brought to the Lambeth Conference in 1920. It was agreed in principle in 2008, since when it's had a huge amount of time and effort, care and love expended upon it by priests and theologians, lawyers and laypeople. Both sides have made significant compromises. The Revision Committee of the General Synod that's produced this draft legislation have got very close to agreement. They can get no closer on one difficult issue in particular, but they invite us to trust one another and make it work. That one issue is absolutely fundamental to our Christian tradition. Abandon it now, and we have to ask ourselves at what point we stop being one holy Catholic and apostolic church and become a sect. The issue relates to the source of the authority that makes a bishop a bishop. Since the very early days of the Christian church, the authority of a bishop has been delegated to him by the archbishops and bishops who ordain and consecrate him. The new bishop then exercises that authority in his own diocese. This tradition will continue with men and women bishops in the proposed legislation. Some of our friends refuse to accept delegated authority from a bishop who is a woman or who is a man tainted by ordaining women or by sharing the Lord's table with women. They say we should invent some other source of authority that will bypass our bishops and our dioceses altogether. Such male bishops would be bishops because the law says so. The General Synod has already debated this at length, voted on it, and rejected it. The famous Archbishop's Amendment that tried to find a solution argued that authority might be held equally by two bishops, one for, one against women priests and bishops, with coordinate jurisdiction. But this too avoids the big issue of traditional delegation or imposition by law. So the suggestion was rejected. It's not a question of lacking charity towards those who disagree. We are as close as we can get if we are to achieve the purpose of the legislation, which is to make it legal for women to be bishops. So now we should hold hands and take that leap of faith together. Opponents should not underestimate the sacrifices being made by the majority of us who accept that in the proposed legislation there can still be parishes where women cannot minister. We must trust each other, and we must trust our bishops as they work on the code of practice. Some friends won't join us on our journey because they say we shouldn't agree to the whole package without knowing what the code says. Their worries are misplaced. The code cannot be approved before the main legislation because it must conform to it. The code must do what it says on the tin in Clause 5. If it doesn't, it will risk legal challenge. And Clause 2 requires that under the code, the arrangements must be made diocese by diocese according to its needs. Our bishop must consult this diocesan synod, and the scheme must be reviewed every 5 years. With integrity, humility, courtesy, and justice, we can forge a new relationship on the anvil of profound disagreement. Let us find it in our hearts to trust each other. With our disagreements and hesitation, what message are we giving to the people of our country about Christians in the Church of England, especially our young people? It matters because we are the church by law established, and we have a legal duty of care towards every citizen of this country. We've always been different from every other church in Europe. Our roots run deep in both the Celtic and Roman traditions, Elizabeth I gave us a lasting Reformation settlement that healed terrible wounds and embedded in us our way of doing things based on scripture, tradition, and reason. That is why the Church of England is so tolerant. It is our tradition to teach the faith in the light of what we know and where we are. I'm not arguing that we should adjust our theology or ecclesiology to suit secular fads. I'm stating clearly that we must proclaim the gospel afresh in each generation. Nor am I saying that Parliament is telling the Church to get in line. It's not. But Parliament does have a responsibility towards the established Church, and we should be glad that it does. It's our own squabbling that is distracting and discrediting our work of mission. We shouldn't indulge in any more delaying tactics. Almost half the priests ordained each year are women, and we should not deprive the House of Bishops of their wisdom, insight, and skill. One of the great leaders of the Church at the Reformation was our own Bishop of Salisbury, John Jewell. In his great book, The Apologia, published in 1562, Bishop Jewell said, "We have planted no new religion, but only renewed the old." Arguing against the dominance of Rome, he said that local churches had the right to legislate through provincial synods. He and many others lit candles that we should take care not to put out, nor forget. Hundreds of good Christians were exiled and martyred along the Reformation road to freedom, independence, and tolerance that we enjoy today. It's the tradition and the duty of our Church to nourish the flame of reform. Bishop John Jewell would surely agree that we're seeking to implant no new religion, only renew the old. This legislation is evolutionary, not revolutionary. It is fair, not unfair. Yet never far below the surface runs an undercurrent of doubt about the role of women in ministry. We should square up to it, as this measure seeks to do. Of course, Jesus chose men as his first disciples. Unmarried women travelling with men was socially unacceptable. Reception of his teaching would have been impossible. The evidence in the Bible is that Jesus understood perfectly well the rules and prejudices of the society in which he lived. Yet he broke a lot of those social rules. He talked to women who were strangers and foreigners. He taught women. He spoke of women as equal to men. He accepted women in his inner circle. His parables are both about men and women. It was mostly women at his crucifixion. He appeared first to women after his resurrection. Jesus trusted women. He engaged with them, depended on them, and encouraged them. So should we. That's what this legislation is seeking to do. Please join me in supporting it. For the love of God is broader than the measure of man's mind, and the heart of the Eternal is most wonderfully kind. But we make his love too narrow, with false limits of our own, and we magnify his strictness with a zeal he will not own. Chairman, I beg to move the motion.
Thank you.